Appendix Nun. Additional information about some of the characters. The Purple Sage. An imaginary Taoist philosopher invented by Lord Omar Khayyam Ravenhurst. Another imaginary Taoist philosopher. Lord Omar Khayyam Ravenhurst. An imaginary Taoist philosopher invented by Mr. Kerry Thornley of Atlanta, Georgia. Mr. Thornley was a friend of Lee Harvey Oswald's. Was accused of complicity in the John Kennedy assassination by District Attorney Jim Garrison. And is the author of Illuminati Lady, an endless epic poem which you really ought to read. George Dorn. His maternal grandfather, old Charlie Bishop, was once a patient of the famous Dr. William Carlos Williams. The Bishops came to New Jersey in 1723, having left Salem, Massachusetts in 1692 under something of a cloud. Folks in the Nutley, Clifton, Passaic, Paterson area always have a good word for the Bishops, though. But the Dorns were all troublemakers, and George's paternal grandfather, Big Bill Dorn, was so indiscreet as to get killed by cops during the Paterson silk mill strike of 1922. Heraclitus. He was apt to say odd things. Once he even wrote that religious ceremonies are unholy. A strange duck. The Squirrel. A set of receptor organs transmitting information through a central nervous system to a small brain programmed for only a few rudimentary decisions. But in this, he was not far inferior to most of our characters. Rebecca Goodman. Her maiden name was Murphy, and she was named after Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm. You thought she was Jewish, didn't you? The Dead Egyptian Mouth Breeders. There were five of them, of course. Danny Price Fixer. Shot in the line of duty 2 years after the events of this story. Loved the music of Johann Sebastian Bach. Adam Weishaupt. He's a deep one, they used to say on the faculty of the University of Ingolstadt. You never know what he's really thinking. Carmel. One of his girls once cajoled a Hollywood character actor into calling him on the phone and pretending to be a researcher for the Kinsey Institute seeking an interview. Carmel couldn't see any money in it and was trying to end the conversation when the actor asked stuffily, "Well, all we want to know, actually, is do you have intercourse with your mother regularly, or does everybody in Las Vegas call you Carmel the motherfucker for some other reason?" For once, Carmel was speechless. The girl spread the story, and everybody in town was laughing about it for weeks. Peter Jackson. His great-grandfather was a slave. His son became the first president of the Lunar Federation after the rebellion of the moon colonists in 2025. Much further back, a more remote ancestor was a king of Atlantis. And way in the future, a descendant was a slave on a planet in the Alpha Centauri system. Peter was one of the crew when Hagbard finally blasted off for the stars in 1999. That's the way the cookie crumbles. And Peter had an intuitive sense of this paradoxical fatality, which caused him to tell Eldridge Cleaver once, "People who say you're either part of the solution or part of the problem are themselves part of the problem." Cleaver replied wittily, "Fuck you." The lab chief who was disinterested in Anthrax Leprosy Delta. He later cracked up and wrote letters to the newspapers attacking the entire chemobiological warfare program of the United States government. Spent the last 17 years of his life receiving treatment in St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Washington, D.C., occupying the same quarters that once housed the ingenious poet Ezra Pound. His rantings were taken seriously in certain places, especially among some leftward-leaning fellow scientists. But the vice president described them to the press as the despondent demagogy of a paranoid pedant. A sample of the man's delusions from a letter to the three top television networks, never quoted on newscasts because it was too controversial. The boast of the 19th century was its conquest of these accursed plagues that attack men, women, and helpless infants indifferently. What shall be said of the 20th century, which has recreated them at great expense and through the efforts of thousands of brilliant but perverted scientific minds, and then stored them live in installations throughout the country, where it is virtually certain statistically that an accident will unleash them upon an unsuspecting public sooner or later? Loonies often harbour morbid fears of that sort. The poor man never responded favourably to any of the efforts of his psychiatrists, even though they gave him ECT, electroconvulsive therapy, so often that his brain was practically fried to the crispness of a Howard Johnson omelette by the time he finally died. Anthrax leprosy delta. A life form that could exist only by destroying other life forms. In this respect, it was like many of us. The first of the products of Charlie Mocenigo's fertile genius, it could boast only of being 10 times as deadly as ordinary anthrax. Insofar as it had consciousness in a vague and flickering way, it was like that inhabiting a subway train at 5 p.m, concerned only with getting where it was going and then eating. The other strains were much the same, up to anthrax leprosy pie. Lee Harvey Oswald, hero of a series of novels by Harold Weisberg, including Whitewash, Whitewash 2, Photographic Whitewash, and Oswald in New Orleans. Villain of another novel entitled Report of the Presidential Commission on the Assassination of President John F. Kennedy by Earl Warren, John McCone, et al. Also featured in other works of fiction by Mark Lane, Penn Jones, Josiah Thompson, and various other writers. Jack Ruby, the Oliver Hardy to Oswald Stanley Laurel. Thomas Jefferson, a revolutionary hemp grower who once wrote, "The clergy believe that any portion of power confided to me will be exerted in opposition to their schemes, and they believe rightly. For I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man. But this is all they have to fear from me, and enough too, in their opinion." Few of the pious tourists who read the italicized portion of this statement carved on the Jefferson Memorial in Washington, D.C., are aware of its context. The schizophrenic in Cherry Knowles Hospital. His number was 124C41. Nobody, anywhere, remembered what his name had been. Mary Lou Cervix. She finally married Jim Riley, the dope dealer from Dayton. But there's another, rather longish story, and not truly relevant. Mayor Richard Daley. Author of such immortal aphorisms as, "After all, I am a liberal myself," October 22, 1968. "The policeman isn't there to create disorder, the policeman is there to preserve disorder," September 23, 1968. "I have conferred with the superintendent of police this morning, and I gave him instructions that an order be issued by him immediately and under his signature to shoot to kill any arsonist or anyone with a Molotov cocktail in his hand, April 17, 1968. "There wasn't any shoot-to-kill order. That was a fabrication, April 18, 1968. "You could say Senator Tower is doing a lousy job, but I don't use that kind of words, May 1, 1962. "I've lived in Chicago all my life, and I still say we have no ghetto in Chicago, July 8, 1963. "We will have a planned development, and we'll take people out of the ghettos and slums and give them an opportunity to raise their families in decent surroundings, April 17, 1969. "I didn't create the slums, did I? September 3, 1968. "Together we must rise to ever higher and higher platitudes. March 13, 1967. The Russian premier. A com simp. Charles Mocenigo's father. A professional. He worked for Charles Lucky, Luciano, Louis Lepke, Buchalter, Federico Maldonado, and many other colourful American businessmen. Known in the trade as Jimmy the Shrew because of his sharp, conniving expression. Saved his money, put his boy through MIT, killed people for a living. Found the original Frank Sullivan performing in Havana, 1934. General Lawrence Stuart Talbot. Actually, there was something between him and that girl from Red Lion, Pennsylvania. Malaclips the Younger, KSC. Author of the Principia Discordia. Disappeared mysteriously in late 1970. His last recorded words were typically, "Comes the dawn, the sun shall rise in the west." And he walked into the Pacific Ocean. John Herbert Dillinger. When Simon Moon read his biography in search of 23s, he missed a good one. John committed 26 robberies during his publicised career, but only 23 were for money. The other three, police stations, seem to have been strictly art for art's sake. Simon's father, Tim Moon. He told Simon the lives of Joe Hill, Big Bill Haywood, Sacco and Vanzetti, and Frank Little, at the age when most boys are being told about Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Simon remembers Joe Hill the night before his execution, wiring Wobbly headquarters in Chicago, "Don't weep for me, boys. Organize." Bartolomeo Vanzetti. "Your laws, your courts, your false god will be a dim remembering of a cursed time when man was wolf to the man." Tim and his cronies singing in the living room. "Which side are you on, man? Which side are you on?" Until Molly complained, "You'll wake the neighbours." Tim explaining Big Bill. "Oh yeah, and he had a glass eye. Funny I should forget that. The real eye was knocked out by a cop during a strike." But you'll understand Tim best if you see Simon, age 6, entering grammar school for the first time and addressing the first boy he meets. "I'm Simon Moon. What's your name, fellow worker?" Padre Pederastia. His real name was Father James Flanagan. Tobias Knight. The only quintuple agent in the history of espionage. James Joyce. After death he met Yates on the fifth plane and said, "Sir, I am now willing to learn from you, since you appear to have been right about death after all." Yates replied, "Not at all. You're dreaming this." The remark so vexed Joyce that he immediately sought reincarnation. The fifth plane was full of mystics like Yates and George Russell and Madame Blavatsky, and Joyce knew his rational Aristotelian sensibility would be constantly abused by further conversation with them. Entered the womb of Elizabeth Mullins of Vernon, New Jersey, October the 11th, 1942, and was aborted December the 10th, 1942. Entered the womb of Rachel Stein of Ingolstadt, January the 18th, 1943, and was gassed with her 1 month before birth was due at Auschwitz, September the 1st, 1943. Thereafter, he retired to a monastery on the sixth plane and wrote his funniest, most bitter book. Parts of it, which he has been transmitting ever since, have been picked up by mediums on the six continents, all of whom assumed they were flipping out and refused to transcribe it. Charles Workman, an entrepreneur. Mindy Weiss, another entrepreneur. Jimmy the Shrew, a third entrepreneur, more successful than the above. See entry under Charles Mossenego's father. Albert the Teacher Stein. Not only did he lose his gamble with immortality when it was proven that he didn't kill Dutch Schultz, but almost every book on the case misspells his name as Stern, a tradition which the present work has mostly refused to shatter. Henry Ford. By importing the protocols of the learned elders of Zion and beginning the mass production of automobiles, he managed to pollute both the mind and the air of the United States. But he meant well. Well, at least he meant something. George Dorn's older brother. His successful scientific career made George envious and helped determine George's choices of a liberal arts curriculum at Columbia. He had an adventure with talking dolphins before George did, which set up a psychic resonance that made George's recruitment interesting to Hagbard. This story is recounted in Tales of the Cthulhu Mythos, edited by August Derleff, Arkham House, 1969. Markov Chaney. He slipped away from Saul and Barney shortly after they returned to Las Vegas, and none of our characters ever saw him again. However, one day in 1984, Hagbard Chaleen, using an alias and engaged in nefarious business, happened to be in the U.S. government printing office on Capitol Street in Washington and noticed a bundle of pamphlets that had been stamped with both blue top secret authorized personnel only and red for immediate release to all media. Many loyal government servants would have headaches before it was ever clarified who had been responsible for which of those stamps, if indeed that ever could be clarified. Hagbard recalled much that Saul had told him about the Las Vegas caper and looked around thoughtfully. In one corner he saw a large coffee urn. He lit one of his long black cigars and strolled out into the street. The sun was bright, the air was clear, and it was spring, which may explain why Hagbard began whistling as he walked with a brisk and determined pace toward the Senate office building. The tune was, "My Heart's in the Highlands."
Greetings. Fuck up here. I hope you enjoyed this unabridged Deep Leaf audio production of Illuminatus Part 3, Leviathan, by Robert Shea and Robert Anton Wilson. This program was produced and directed by Lance Boucher, featuring the voice talents of Ontario Arley, Mark Atherley, Glenn Carlson, Digby Christian, Scott Crisp, Melissa Hutchison, Marilyn Fowler, Wendy Tremont King, John Mercer, Jay Momay, Eddie Nix, John Parsons, Douglas Smith, John True, Perry Whittle, and Randall Wung, with appendices by Ken Campbell. Recorded at What You Say Studios, San Francisco, and Resonance Studios, London. Production copyright 2007, Deep Leaf Productions. If you listen to this program via a borrowed or pirated copy, please consider paying for it at deepleafaudio.com. Or at least convince or otherwise hypnotize a friend or foe to purchase a copy. All hail Discordia. Praise Bob.